Now, we've been monitoring EU justice and home affairs policy well since before the Maastricht Treaty. Move it back. Okay. So we've been looking at justice and home affairs policy since before the EU was created formally by the Maastricht Treaty, and I'm going to talk about the kind of things that we've seen over the past 15 years. Like the others, I'll start by saying that EU policy and international law in general is extremely boring. It's very technical, and there's lots of it. Thousands of laws, conventions, regulations, decisions, directives, framework directives, resolutions, and so on. A revolution, if only. But it is also extremely important in terms of our civil liberties. The European Union now calls itself an area of freedom, security, and justice, the stated purpose of which is to combat illegal immigration, organised crime, and, of course, terrorism. Now, most people are aware that this is producing some kind of Fortress Europe. Fortress Europe is an ideology which has enshrined an institutional code of racism that defines all third world peoples as immigrants and refugees, and all immigrants and refugees as terrorists and drug runners, and cannot tell a citizen from an immigrant or an immigrant from a refugee, let alone one black from another. The words of A.C. Fernandez. So we'll start with Fortress Europe. Thanks to the Amsterdam Treaty, the EU now has a common immigration and asylum policy. This is based on 8 key areas. Firstly, immigration controls, measure after measure after measure, aimed at preventing people getting into the EU and criminalising those that do. This in turn has created the so-called people trafficking rackets, lucrative for organised criminals and not a few border guards, and it's created a black market in forged documents. It also forces people who do manage to get into the EU to work and live underground. Not underground, but in the black economy. This, in turn, leads to tougher and tougher law enforcement measures, with the result that the risks increase and more people die trying to get here. Thousands of people. Who kills them? Okay, so next we have the common visa policy. This is based on a white list, it's actually called the white list, of 44 countries whose nationals do not require a visa for short stays. North American, South American countries, Australia, Israel, and a couple of former colonies in Asia. Third, the EU has rules on external borders, and increasingly militarised borders they are. The German-Poland border had 5,500 guards. By the time the EU's eastern border controls are shifted to the new member states, Poland's eastern border will be guarded by more than 10,000 border guards. But at least we have free movement inside the EU. Well, that's except when there are demonstrations against the EU or other organisations such as the G8, when states are free to reintroduce border controls, as they have done on more than a dozen occasions. And we also have a proposed EU border police. Proposals to rewrite the law of the sea, which has existed for decades and decades, to allow the EU law enforcement agencies to intercept and immediately return migrants from whence they came. This would remove the presumption of innocent passage and the duty of care that is established in the law of the sea. Fourth, the EU asylum policy, swathes of policy based on denial, prevention and deterrence. There is no legal route into the EU for refugees, so they too have to use illegal methods, and then they can be punished for entering illegally. The first method of punishment is the Dublin Convention. This ties border controls to asylum responsibilities, so if a refugee enters illegally, which they invariably will have done, they can be returned to the state which accidentally admitted them. Now, in practice, these are likely to be Central and Eastern European countries who have the least developed asylum systems and are thus the least able to cope. This is one of the principles of the buffer state system. Next, EC law has enshrined the safe country of origin concept into EU law, allowing member states to declare applications from certain nationals as manifestly unfounded or otherwise inadmissible. This includes, for example, Palestinian refugees who technically receive UN protection. I don't know about you, but I haven't seen much peacekeeping in the occupied territories just lately. Next, thanks to the UK and Germany, EU law now encourages or will encourage member states to detain asylum seekers in processing centres, to order applicants to stay in a specific place, to provide demeaning vouchers rather than cash to destitute applicants, to restrict access to healthcare to emergency treatment only, to prevent asylum seekers working, to limit schooling for children to accommodation centres, and to limit the situations in which people can be reunited with their family. Next, the EU encourages the grant of what's called temporary protection or subsidiary protection. So in practice, very few refugees are actually recognised as such, and any rights they have are temporary or restricted. The fifth aspect of the Common Immigration Asylum Policy is legal migration, and the EU does claim to have a credible policy on rights for legally resident third country nationals. But domestic courts and the European courts have consistently ruled that if someone is in the EU, they're not from an EU country, they should have the equivalent rights that we ourselves receive. So what the EU has done is consolidated some of these rights and restricted others. But the most important thing it's done is to make legal migration dependent upon a policy of registration and surveillance. This is the sixth unspoken EU immigration asylum policy. First, all potential entrants are checked against the Schengen Information System, a kind of EU-wide police national computer into which national authorities input stolen items, people wanted for arrest and extradition, the European arrest warrant will be issued like this, fugitives and threats to public order and national security. Member states are encouraged to register rejected asylum seekers, illegal immigrants and immigrants convicted of criminal offences. There are around 1 million people registered on the SIS for this reason. Next, all applicants for asylum are fingerprinted, and the fingerprints are stored on a central EU database called Eurodac. Illegal immigrants who are apprehended in the EU are also checked against this database. Now, the Eurodac regulation made national fingerprint databases mandatory. So what happened is many of the member states went further than the common rules at the EU level. So the UK police and immigration services, for example, are now equipped with handheld scanners to check for known illegals, and you can see them at Victoria train station. In Sweden, there have been media reports of immigrants mutilating their fingers to render their fingerprints illegible to the new technology, with scars from deliberate cuts and burns. This is the human cost of Eurodac. On top of the Schengen Information System, we have the proposed Visa Information System, which will be merged with the Schengen Information System. Again, quite technical. But this will contain the personal details from every visa application to the EU, so whether it's approved or rejected. So we're now going to be registering another 500,000 third country nationals per year on EU databases. If a visa is approved, we're then going to take the fingerprints from the visa applicant, include them in a chip on the visa itself, and add it to another EU database. And all residence permits issued in the EU to legally resident third country nationals will also include fingerprints. So technically, we are going to fingerprint every third country national, legal or illegal, coming into the EU. Now, this will lead to a de facto EU-wide foreigners register, something that the German government has long been proposing. Now, there is an obvious, if unspoken, link between a policy of registration and surveillance and the EU's expulsion policy. Checks and restrictions on refugees, asylum seekers, visa holders, residents, third country nationals are implicitly tied to removing them from the EU and preventing their return. This is the seventh EU policy, expulsion. Now, EU law means that if you are now expelled from one member state, that decision applies in all the others. So a national expulsion decision means expulsion from the entire EU, as well as registration on the Schengen Information System. More recently, the EU has agreed on joint expulsion flights. We'll just round up all the people we're sending back from the different member states, put them on a single plane to cut costs. This is a practice supposedly banned by a protocol to the Geneva Convention. And the EU has also agreed on funding these expulsions from the community budgets. All of this against the wishes of the European Parliament. The final aspect of EU immigration policy is immigration controls in third countries. This began with the buffer states, the countries of Central and Eastern Europe, but these are now full EU members. So now we're looking to new neighbours to the east of the extended EU. Readmission agreements are the key to cooperation with these third states. These force third countries to take back their own nationals, even if they have no documents and even if their nationality is in doubt. Third world aid and trade is now increasingly dependent upon readmission obligations, and the buffer state policy has been extended globally. The developing world must now take steps to prevent illegal emigration, and money is being channeled away from development projects to realise this. And then if the developing world objects, the EU simply threatens to withdraw aid and trade. So the only policy that people almost universally agree will reduce migration pressure on the EU, development in the third world, is being undermined by the EU itself.